Alison Desforges went to Rwanda last month to gather information about the genocide that took place there almost exactly 1 year before. She ended up witnessing the aftermath of a massacre. On April 22nd, at refugee camps in Rwanda, at least 2,000 civilians were killed by Rwandan soldiers, according to estimates of human rights groups. Desforges was in the camps just before and just after the massacre. She's co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda and a consultant to Human Rights Watch. This massacre happened 1 year after a civil war between the Hutu and Tutsi ethnic groups. The Hutu president was killed, and Hutus responded with the genocide of 500,000 Tutsis. But then a Tutsi-led army took over the country, and tens of thousands of Hutus, many of whom participated in the genocide, ended up in refugee camps. Last month's massacre took place at 4 refugee camps, which were encircled by Rwandan army troops the week of April 18th. The largest camp is called Kibeho.
Kibeho, when I arrived on April the 19th, was a mass of people forced into a very small area. There was still a dense pall of cooking smoke, smoke from cooking fires hanging over the area. People were huddled together, afraid, because they had been forced into this enclosed mass by soldiers using gunfire, firing in the air at that point, and using sticks.
Why were they forced into this area?
The camps have existed since last summer, when the French established a protected zone in this part of Rwanda. When the French did so, people who were afraid of the new government, which was being established after the genocide, people who were afraid either because they had been implicated in the genocide or because they thought other people thought they had been implicated in the genocide, those people fled into this zone under French protection. After the French left and the Rwandan government established its control, the people remained in these displaced persons camps under UN protection. Many of them were afraid to go home because there had been and there still is a considerable amount of insecurity on their on the hillsides in their home communities. People have been arrested, sometimes unjustly accused of genocide, and whether they are rightly or wrongly accused, they have not been brought to trial. So people who were in the camps who knew about these arrests were afraid to go home, afraid to be arrested themselves and end up with spending months in jail with no immediate prospect of trial or release. Among those people in the camps, there was a certain number of former militia members, people who had been actively involved in the genocide. They had among them some weapons, a certain number of machetes, which Rwandans often have with them just for cutting wood, but also a small number, a very small number of guns. The Rwandan government was anxious to close the camps because this was obviously an abnormal condition to have a substantial part of the national population clustered together in these camps. And there had also been a certain amount of banditry and attacks on neighboring populations that had been launched from the camps. I think they were also afraid eventually of infiltration from Zaire, where people who had been involved in the genocide had taken refuge, and they were afraid that these people would come into the country and find a base of operation in the camps. So they had a legitimate concern and wanted to close the camps.
So on April 18th, the government announced it was going to close the camps.
Yeah, there had been a process of planning going on for an orderly closure, which involved various international non-governmental organizations that had been providing humanitarian aid in the camps.
You were involved in these negotiations?
No, I was because our mandate as a human rights organization is not to provide those services such as food, water, and so on. We were outside observers, but we were well informed of the progress of the negotiations. What was surprising was that the program for an orderly closing of the camps was just about completed, And this would have provided for people being dispersed to their home communities without a serious incident. But the very morning of the final meeting to settle the plan for an orderly closure of the camps, the military moved without notice to the international community, but moved to encircle the camps and simply declared them closed. As they did so, they cut the supply of water. They refused to allow any food deliveries, and they closed the areas that provided the clinics that provided medical services in the camps. At the same time, they restricted people's access to latrines. In the first couple of days, when I visited the camps, there had been no heavy rainfall, and people were suffering from thirst more than from anything else. They had bits and pieces of food left over in their stocks that they were continuing to cook and consume. So food wasn't so much a problem as water. There were children who were seriously dehydrated, old people who were seriously dehydrated, and the provider of water, which was Oxfam, its staff spent a great deal of time negotiating, trying to get water back into the camps. But by the end of the week, by Thursday and Friday, there had been heavy rains for 2 days, and people were standing in a sea of mud. Because they also did not have access to latrines, they were forced to take care of their needs on the spot, so that mixed with the mud was a substantial amount of human excrement. People had no place to sit or to lie down. They were hungry, they were thirsty, and they were very afraid.
And then what happened next? There was a stampede?
There had been a stampede the very first day when they began closing the camps, where 9 people died, 8 of them children. Then on Thursday night, exactly why, I'm not sure. At that point, there was no talk of a stampede. There was talk maybe of some provocation from the crowd. I'm not sure. But Thursday evening at 6 o'clock, the troops fired into the crowd and killed 21 people, wounded 48. The next day, when I walked around in the crowd and talked to people, they were very, very afraid that the same thing was going to happen that night as well. There had also been, during the night, an attack by machete. People who, in the midst of the crowd, all of a sudden pulled out machetes and started to hack at other people, killing 3 of them and wounding some 30 others. We don't know who these assailants were, whether they were militia members who were trying to create panic so that people would attempt to run, and then this would provoke some retaliation by the Rwandan army troops, or whether they were planted by someone from the army side who wanted to sow terror among people. We don't know. We do know that 3 of the assailants were arrested and are in the hands of UN troops, so there is some hope of finding out who had ordered this kind of attack by machete during the night. But by Friday morning, there had been the 2 kinds of attacks, the gunfire and the machete attacks, and people in the crowd were seriously worried. As I talked to them late Friday afternoon, some were talking about trying to organize an almost suicidal attempt to escape. Now, the irony is that the whole operation was designed to evacuate the camps, to close them, but people were not allowed to leave.
What do you mean they weren't allowed to leave? I mean, the government wanted them to go
right,
so they could close down the camp.
Right. But they wanted them to leave only after they had been searched, and only after there had been some registration process, so that they would know who had been in the camps and where these people were going, what communes they were going back to, what home communities they were going back to. People were afraid of this whole procedure. They thought that at the time of being searched or the time of being registered, they were also going to be arrested, they were going to be hauled off to jail, they were going to be killed, whatever. So that during the night, some people did, in fact, in small numbers, filter through the periphery of soldiers, so that each day the crowd was smaller by several thousand, perhaps by as many as 10,000 a day, fleeing overnight in this sort of spontaneous and disorganized way. But by Friday evening, people were talking about a massive attempt to break out of this circle of soldiers, to try to force their way through, even if it was a suicidal attempt. They were that convinced that as soon as night fell, there would be more killing, and they felt better to take their chances and to try to flee. I was one of the people who said, don't do it. Remain calm. Don't try this. There are UN soldiers here. They are meant to protect you. Surely what happened last night is not going to be repeated.
But then what happened Saturday morning?
In fact, it was repeated Friday night. Mm. So that by Saturday morning, there were 60 people dead and several hundred wounded. And then Saturday morning, beginning fairly early in the morning, troops opened fire that morning. At noontime, they fired again for approximately 2 hours. And then at 5 o'clock, 10 past 5 in the afternoon, when people did in fact try to break out, about 1,500 people apparently tried to flee, the troops again opened fire and mowed them down. So that there were in fact 5 separate incidents when the troops fired into the crowd. Then on Sunday morning, when I was there, I saw soldiers chasing and shooting people who were attempting to flee across the hills.
How many people do you estimate were massacred?
I did not see any vast number of bodies myself, so that my estimations really are based on what I heard from soldiers and doctors who were there connected with the UN or with private aid agencies. But from a number of different sources, the number that I would accept as a minimum is 2,000, and it may go as high as 4,000 or even higher than that.
My guest is Alison DeForge, a consultant to Human Rights Watch. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alison DeForge, a consultant to Human Rights Watch and co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda. She was in the Rwandan refugee camps last month, just before and just after soldiers massacred an estimated 2,000 people. When you got to the camp on Sunday morning after the massacre, what did you find there?
Well, an area of total desolation and devastation. People's belongings strewn everywhere. Personal papers, photographs, articles of clothing, pots and pans, food, everything strewn over a vast area. And then in one corner of the camp, approximately 10,000 people left who were being organized into a foot convoy to evacuate the final numbers of people who are still alive and ready to walk out. About 200 men seated alongside of a roadway where the convoy was being organized, men under guard, obviously, who had been arrested, virtually all of them young men. And in the two compounds, which were controlled by UN soldiers, about 100 UN soldiers in each compound, in one of them, several hundred children, most of them very small, completely traumatized, disoriented. People with various forms of injuries. An old woman with half her shoulder blown off. A young man wandering around completely traumatized and out of touch with reality, stumbling into the paths of vehicles, lying down under trucks. People who didn't respond to greetings, who didn't answer questions, who are completely traumatized and shocked by what they had seen and experienced.
What about the bodies of the dead? Were the bodies still around?
There were very few bodies in evidence. We were not allowed into the camp until nearly noontime on Sunday. And at that point, we were allowed into only a very restricted area, just the immediate vicinity of the UN compounds, which is where the wounded were being assembled and treated. The witnesses who had been present during the night said that bodies had been buried throughout the night, that they had heard the sounds of activity during the night as the dead were taken away or buried. And in the morning hours before our arrival, both UN troops and Rwandan army troops had been engaged in burying people in mass graves.
Did you try to get testimony from survivors about what happened?
Well, you have to remember that the witnesses themselves were observing only a small part of the action. That's one aspect that's hard to appreciate, but when you have 80,000 people who are being shot at by some 2,500 other people, it's hard for anyone to have a view of the whole. Certainly not if you're in the midst of the crowd. Most people could only tell me what they had seen, what they had heard, and only by piecing together small bits of information can you get to a whole. So we, in fact, have some notion, but we don't have a complete picture. We're hoping that the International Commission of Inquiry, which has been appointed at the request of the Rwandan government, will, in fact, be able to provide us with a definitive version of what happened.
Was it just by luck that you weren't in the camp on Saturday, the day of the massacre?
Yes, it was purely happenstance. Although various representatives of other international aid organizations were told to leave the camp during the course of Saturday, so that very few foreign representatives were there at the time of the final shooting late in the afternoon.
Does that lead you to suspect that this was being planned and that's why the aid workers were asked to leave?
Anytime there is a series of five incidents where troops fire into a crowd of civilians, there has to be there has to have been some opportunity to have stopped the shooting at some point. This, more than anything else, indicates to me a level of decision at a fairly high-ranking level in terms of the use of lethal force against these crowds. I don't believe that there was a plan laid out ahead of time to massacre people and that this was put into effect from beginning to end, but I do believe that it was apparent from very early on that conditions existed which were bound to result in serious loss of human life, and nothing was done to alleviate those conditions.
Were you able to function that Sunday when you got to the camp after the massacre?
This was the first time I had ever been in such a situation. What I found, and I believe my experience was not too different from that of other people in similar situations, is that you remove yourself from the scene, and it takes place in front of you in a very remote way. You see the wounds, you see the people who are dead, you smell things, you touch things, you hear things, but somehow you're not present. It's not possible to be fully present as a human being, feeling human being in that situation and still function effectively.
When did what happened register in its full emotional way?
It's still happening. Even as I sit here, right, twisting my ring, it's difficult every time I talk about it. Each time you unfreeze a little bit more and feel it a little bit more.
Were you worried about your own life?
No, really not. I had no sense of being at risk personally at all. Even when I saw people being shot, it was as if it was taking place in another realm, almost in a film I was watching, and I had no sense that I was at all at risk.
The survivors of the massacre who left the camp, did any of the human rights workers follow them to see if they would be given safe passage? You said a lot of the people who fled the camp were being shot at by soldiers.
People who fled spontaneously, not as part of the convoys, were shot at by soldiers. The convoys who left the camps were set upon by local civilian populations and were beaten, were attacked with stones and with sticks rather than being shot at. We saw the evidence along the two roads that led out of Kibeho camp and Kamana camp of people having been attacked and having thrown down all of their possessions as they fled in panic. For several miles leaving each camp, you drove over roads where you couldn't see the road at all because of the layer of people's possessions, the food, the photographs, the letters, the books, the clothing, all along the road and stretching down along the side of the road, down into the valleys and up the hillsides beyond the valleys, where people had obviously fled, throwing their things as they ran. Some monitors accompanied people back from transit points partway along the way back to their home communes, and the intensity of the monitoring presence became far more effective as time went on. In the early days, in the very first days, when there was violence in the camps and when the convoys were first sent out, there was very little effective UN presence, either in terms of monitors or in terms of troops.
Last April, just a year ago, there was a civil war in Rwanda that culminated in an extraordinary, genocide is what people have called it. And last year, what happened was that the Hutus were attacking the Tutsis. Since the civil war, the Tutsis have been in power. And the massacre that happened a couple of weeks ago in the refugee camp was Tutsis massacring Hutus. It's extraordinary.
I don't find the killings of this year all that astonishing, simply because there has been no consequence, there has been no punishment for the people guilty of the genocide. Following the genocide, the judicial system suffered enormously. Many judges were killed. There were judges who were accused of having participated in the killings. Most of the police were killed or fled. Most of the prosecutors were dead. When I first met with the new Minister of Justice to talk about how to prosecute the genocide, how to bring to trial tens of thousands of people accused of killing their neighbors, I met him in his hotel room in Kigali, which was where he was living and where he was working. He had no telephone. He had no typewriter. He had no computer. He had no vehicle to get outside of his hotel, to get anywhere in the city, far less anywhere in the country. And he was faced with the daunting task of putting into operation a judicial system which would deal with a challenge that would have overwhelmed any ordinary operating judicial system that had been up and functioning in good shape.
Alison DeForge is a consultant to Human Rights Watch. She'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Alison DeForge was in the Rwandan refugee camps last month, just before and just after Rwandan soldiers of the Tutsi ethnic group massacred an estimated 2,000 Hutus in the camps. DeForge is a consultant to Human Rights Watch and co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda. In the first part of our talk, she told us about the events leading up to the massacre and about what she witnessed when she arrived at the camp after the massacre. DeForge had gone to Rwanda in April to document what had happened 1 year before, when Hutus slaughtered an estimated 500,000 Tutsis. So you've been in the position of monitoring horrible human rights abuses, genocide, massacre, on human rights abuses on both sides. Plus, I think you're also concerned with the condition of the people who are being held in detention, who are being accused of participating in the genocide. So I'm just thinking, you know, am I right that you're trying to look out for all sides as absolute madness breaks out in the country?
It's a very, very difficult situation. Take, for example, when the people returned from the displaced persons camps, many of them were suspected of having participated in the genocide. Many of them were accused. They were locked up in communal lockups in inhumane conditions. In one of those communal lockups, 28 people died of suffocation simply because there were too many of them stuffed into too small a room. The local military officer appeared soon after this tragedy and released all of the other people who had been locked up. And since that time, in several other communes, detainees have been released by the judicial authorities because the appropriate legal procedures haven't been followed in locking them up, and the conditions inside are inhumane. Now, as a human rights activist and as a human rights organization, we should presumably stand up and cheer and say, look, someone has done the right thing. These people have been released. But what is the eventual consequence? You now have people back in the community who are suspected of genocide. This means that those survivors of genocide may well turn on these people and create their own vengeance, right? Take reprisals because they see nothing happening on the official front. Or conversely, the people who have been released and are now at large may indeed have been guilty of genocide and may turn on those victims, those survivors of the genocide, and kill those who remain, who managed to survive the genocide, because they're afraid that they will be used as witnesses against them if judicial procedures ever begin again. So you have a situation out on the hills where everyone is afraid of everyone, and where there can be no hope of any form of stability or security until some form of state of law, some state of order is created.
Well, it sounds hopeless until that's created.
It is hopeless until it's created.
I'd like to ask you about the UN. There are UN peacekeeping troops who have been in Rwanda. There were troops at the camps where the massacre happened. Did the troops do anything to try to intervene?
The situation varied from one camp to another. There was one camp where the troops tried early on to improve the conditions, to make water available, for example, where people were suffering from serious dehydration. But in general, the troops played a very passive role. And certainly at Kibeho, when the active shooting went on, the troops, to my knowledge, made no effort to intervene to halt the firing, to make the Rwandan troops stop shooting. I can, from my own direct eyewitness experience, tell you that the UN commanding officer was unable to provide any form of escort to the foot convoys going home, to people who were attacked on the route home, because, he told me, he had been unable to reach an agreement with Rwandan authorities about the arrangements and how they should be carried out. Certainly his mandate gave him whatever authority he needed to assign his own soldiers to protect these people, but he did not do so. I believe he felt, as a pragmatic matter, that he simply didn't have the strength to do so. Within the camp itself...
You mean the strength in numbers?
In numbers, right. Within the camp itself, at the height of the crisis, there were approximately 200 UN soldiers. They were surrounded by a dense crowd of some 80,000 civilians. And beyond that was an outer perimeter where you had the Rwandan soldiers firing into the crowd. There was no way that the UN soldiers could effectively intervene except by going out through the crowd and exposing themselves to the fire of the Rwandan troops, and this they chose not to do. The question is not so much why did they not fire back at that time, why did they not react on the spot, but rather how could they have gotten into such a position when it was generally known in the area that thousands of Rwandan army troops were being massed in the region, that they were arriving with heavy arms, including rocket-propelled grenade launchers, heavy machine guns, and so on. This was common knowledge among the humanitarian agencies working in the area, among people who simply observed the troop movements along the roads. Certainly the UN knew that. Why were they not prepared to act?
What action could they have taken?
Well, at some point, they would have needed to have intervened fairly firmly with the local military commander in terms of discussing why these troops were being massed in the area and what the intention was for their use. And certainly if these discussions had proved unproductive, it would have been appropriate for the UN troops to have, on their side, increased the numbers of men and materiel available locally in order to carry out the mandate which they clearly had to protect the displaced people.
So what exactly did the UN have the authority to do?
It had the authority to use force as necessary to carry out its mandate, and its mandate was to protect civilian populations and to protect the displaced. There are two articles under which peacekeeping and peacemaking operations are created. Article 6, which is technically a peacekeeping operation, and Article 7, which is technically a peacemaking operation. Traditionally, Article 6 operations have the authority to fire only to protect themselves in self-defense, whereas those authorized under Article 7 have the authority to fire in order to enforce the peace. Now, the original UN operation in Rwanda was clearly an Article 6 peacekeeping rather than peacemaking operation, and that's why the troops on the spot were unable to act last year to intervene to stop the genocide. When the second UN operation was sent, as of May 17th last year, it was with a mandate that was larger than Article 6, but yet not quite Article 7. But it did provide for the use of force as necessary to carry out the mandate of protecting civilian populations.
What are the human rights groups that you represent recommending?
We're recommending several things. First of all, to the international community, we're recommending immediate and extensive aid to the Rwandan judicial system to make possible trials so that we can restore some form of security and a state of law within the country. We're recommending to the Rwandan government that it make these trials its first priority, and that it, in the meantime, use all media to reassure the population and to inform people about the appropriate steps to be taken if they find people in their community whom they suspect of being guilty of genocide. We feel these measures are absolutely crucial to trying to avoid immediate and extensive violence on the hills.
Alison DeForge, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Alison DeForge is a consultant to Human Rights Watch and co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda. She plans to return to Rwanda in a few weeks. This is Fresh Air.